So then we all get down to Gibraltar. A fellow down there says, Dutch, he says, when you guys, we're going to have a briefing tonight, you're invited. I says, I have to go to another briefing. So I went, and the guy says, about a certain nighttime hour, go up in a rock, you're going to see a very stirring sight. And I saw one of the most stirring flights I ever saw during the war, where I'm up there in the rock, and I hear the American Navy talking to the British Navy. British Navy on land, the American Navy at sea. They were coming through the strait. And they were coming through. Nothing was going to stop them. They were coming through, and suddenly it was dark. All of a sudden, all the lights on the fleet, their fleet, went on. It was a small fleet compared to Normandy. It was a small fleet compared to what we are going to have at Japan. But to see the U.S. Navy, and this is the first good thing I'm going to say about the Navy in this thing, whole thing. But to see the U.S. Navy out there at sea with all those lights on, they all went on instantly. That's all. Somebody gave a command. All the lights went on the fleet, and the whole fleet was lit up. And they were going through the streets. Nothing was going to stop them. Submarines were not going to stop them, obviously. Warships were not going to stop them. It looked like an Air Force or a Navy that was inseparable from anything else, steaming right through the straits. So then I went back and went to bed. I thought I was going to finally get a good night's sleep. And I was called the next morning, and they says, you're going to take 14 Spitfires out over to Algiers. I says, good. Am I going to do it personally? No, you're just a navigator for them. I says, okay. So we're 14 Spitfires. We're going to leave Gibraltar, and we're going to Algiers. Algiers is about the range for Spitfires. And as we approach to Algiers, the Spitfire pilots, we're above the clouds. The Spitfire pilots are calling me everything except nice and everything else. And they're saying, where's this goddamn Yank taking us? Does he know where he's at? I can't see anything. All that whole bunch of things going bad. So anyhow, I called Paul Tibbetts, and I told him, I says, that's me they're talking about. Will you tell him where to go? And he says, go ahead, tell him. And I called him and told him, I says, you guys go 14 miles straight ahead, drop below the clouds. There's an airfield, land on it. I hope it's captured. We took off. We didn't even know whether we had captured the airfield for the Germans or not. End of that story.
Thank you, Dutch. Gene Wiedekemper, where are you? Gene, come on up, wherever you are, please. Gene is a pilot of this B-17. We're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to fly the B-17. But let's take a little break here, Dutch, and get some water. And
you know, it's just a big lighter. Sorry? It's just a big lighter.
Oh, yeah. He's a pilot, right? He's got to be a liar. Come on up, Gene. Have you met Dutch? This is Gene Wiedekemper, everybody. He used to fly for Northwest. Now he flies for Delta. 747 captain. I'd like to recognize this beautiful B-17 behind us. Yankee Lady belongs to the Yankee Air Museum over at Ypsilanti, Michigan. And Gene is one of their pilots. I'm very lucky. I get to fly the EA's airplane, the B-17, aluminum overcast. So, you know, Gene, what's it like for you to go around the country and meet these veterans that flew them in combat?
You know, that's the exciting part about it, is being able to meet people that are really excited about the history of World War II and the B-17. And it used to be we see so many veterans from World War II, less and less all the time. But what we see now are the grandchildren that are really interested in this airplane, and they want to know everything about it. They want to know what Grandpa did.
And it's a very emotional thing for people.
Very emotional.
Every family had someone associated with B-17s, I believe, in World War II. Either they built them or worked on them or flew them or whatever, they had an uncle or granddad or whatever that was associated with B-17s. Is that true, Dutch?
Yeah, there were an awful lot of us.
Well, I tell you, when those people come up to the airplane that were actually combat pilots, I can just about spot them. They have this look on their face like they're seeing an old friend after a long time. Is that right, Gene?
That's absolutely right, and you can spot them a long ways away. And you probably have heard this story, and I'll repeat this, but many times they stand back and they'll look at this airplane from a distance, and they get closer and closer over a period of time. Sometimes it'll take 30 minutes. Once they get up to this airplane, sometimes we've seen this happen, they'll touch the airplane, and when they touch it, they just break down in tears. It's just like a reunion with the B-17 once again, and it is emotional. It really is.
Yep. I've seen guys tell their families stories in front of me, and their sons or grandsons said, "Wow, we've never heard that." And he'll tell me because he knows what I've, you know, I'm a historian and I know what he went through. But he won't tell his family because he doesn't want them to be hurt.
And that's absolutely right. They don't tell the family until they have this reunion with the B-17 and they start talking to the crew members. And once that happens, the doors have opened and the family hear the stories they've never heard in their life.
Thank you. Now we're going to talk about probably the most famous air mission in history. And you know, all of us are witness to history on occasion, but to make history is something else. So Dutch, would you relate that story to us, please?
I assume you're talking about the time Tom Ferriby sold his B-17 to the Arabs for 1,000 eggs.
Well, no, I had not heard that, but if you'd like to tell it, go right ahead.
Well, that is another story and everything of that type. When we get down to North Africa, we had lots of fresh eggs. Tom found an Arab that had lots of eggs, traded our B-17 to an Arab for 1,000 fresh eggs. That Arab was standing there every time we took off, waving at us, greeting us when we came back. One day we took off and didn't come back. That was the end of that story. No, you have to be talking about the flight of the Enola Gay. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Well, in spite of what most of you people think, it was a very unassuming flight. The Japanese were not even shooting at us that day. So if the Japanese had nothing that could get up to our altitude of 31,000 feet. So they couldn't shoot at us if they wanted to. There is a book published by the Smithsonian, one of the Smithsonian guys, which says that a Japanese fighter came up, did a slow roll around us, and then went away. Now, I don't know what Jake Beezer was smoking that day, but if he wasn't on our airplane or anything of that type, because we saw no opposition whatsoever. We had trained extensively for that mission. Paul Tibbets practiced his flight so that he could make the turn in less than a minute. That says something in a B-29 at 31,000 feet. He racked it up into about a 60-degree bank, and when the time came, Tom Ferriby was flying the airplane. We switched the automatic pilot off. Paul went into the turn. We started running away. A lot of people want to know, does that maneuver have a name? I said, yeah, it's called getting the hell away from the bomb, and this sort of thing. And then we got a lot of turbulence and everything else. And then we turned around to the right to take a look at what had happened. It took 43 seconds from the time the bomb left the airplane until the time it exploded at 1,800 feet. In that 43 seconds, we put 20 miles distance between the bomb going forward and us going backwards. And it put 12 miles between the bomb and us. Thank God that was far enough. If not, I would not be here. But anyhow, we were about 12 miles away. When we turned around to take a look at what had happened, the large white cloud you've all seen pictures of that was had formed already, and it was up well above our altitude, I'd say 50,000 feet. And around the base of the cloud, the entire city of Hiroshima was simply covered with black smoke and dust. You could make no visual observation whatsoever. All you could see were a few fires burning in the periphery of the target, out on the edges, down toward the docks. It was obvious we weren't going to be able to see anything, so we flew a little bit into the southeast quadrant, and then we decided to go home. And all the way gone home, we were waiting for some Japanese announcement that they were surrendering. The Japanese did not surrender, and I have a theory about that. They did not surrender because their program, atomic program, was based on U-235, the same as ours. We used all of the U-235 made at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, in our one bomb. All subsequent, the Hiroshima, the Nagasaki bomb, and all subsequent bombs were made of plutonium. We never made another U-235 bomb, except for medical terms and things of that type. Now there's somebody that works at Oak Ridge that's going to make me a liar and everything, and I don't blame you. But to my knowledge, we never made another U-235 bomb. Went back to the base, didn't hear anything. Had a briefing. Marsh Jepson was the assistant to Admiral Parsons. A bunch of his Navy friends met him. They invited him to come down to their mess for a good meal. They went down there and had a nice dinner. Afterwards, they were sitting around talking about what they were doing in the war, to win the war. Well, came Morris's turn to Tatsuya and everything. He says, oh, we won the war today. They laughed. The next morning, they were around to apologize. So that's the story of the mission.
I tell you what, there are estimates that if we had to invade Japan, we would have lost 1 million, maybe even 2 million men in that invasion. So they were not going to give up, and that's why we had to drop the second bomb, right?
That is correct. I was making my own estimates of the number of casualties because they were building hospitals all over the Marianas Islands. There was not a level space on the Marianas Islands where we did not have a hospital. Of course, we enjoyed the nurses coming into CF hospitals and everything of that type. But aside from that, if they had filled all those hospitals, we would have had an enormous number of casualties. I don't know how many casualties in terms of numbers we would have had, but it would have been outstandingly large. People who would have died were Japanese civilians, and they were going to be arming and fighting with even bamboo staves and things of that type, and they would have died. I would have said that the population of Japan could have been almost wiped out.
So in that regard, it really saved a lot of lives. Yeah. Gene, I had a layover in Narita, and the hotel there is in the little town of Narita, and they had posted a notice on our bulletin board, and it said, if you would come in uniform to the local elementary school, actually they were eighth grade, so I guess that's middle school, kids, they want you to talk to their English class in uniform. So I went down there, and the lady said, welcome, and the teacher, and she said, I asked, is there anything you don't want to talk about? She said, yeah, don't talk about World War II. And she was very emphatic about it. So I said, wow, that's the mindset. I guess they lost, huh?
What did you talk about?
We talked about a lot of things, and their English is pretty doggone good, too.
Yeah.
Did you do that, Gene?
No, I've never done the school, but their English is extremely, extremely good. I want to bring one thing up. I've asked this question. You know, we have flight attendants are from Japan. Do you call it Hiroshima or do you call it Hiroshima? And I noticed that you called it Hiroshima, which I've always called it Hiroshima. Well, the flight attendants say it is Hiroshima, not Hiroshima.
Hey. Oh, Dutch is correct.
Dutch was correct.
I may not be correct, but I said Hiroshima, and I stick by it.
I like it.
Dutch, I'd like your last thoughts on your mission and what this means to history.
Thank you very much. Please take in mind, we did not go out and drop a bomb simply to cause civilian casualties. We dropped the bombs in order to end the war. There were an awful lot of American people over there scheduled for an invasion. They were going to get shot at unless we did something. We had the bomb. We dropped the bomb. The Japanese would have done the same thing. That's all I can say on that.
Thank you, Dutch.